This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a recording of the 2026 Royal Historical Society German Historical Institute lecture given by Vinita Damodaran, Professor of South Asian History at the University of Sussex, on decolonizing the natural history collections of empire. The lecture, with a focus on India, aims to understand this important archive of knowledge of the natural world collected and organized in the context of the empire in the light of recent historiography on botany and empire. It highlights the importance of creating an inventory and digitally repatriating botanical specimens held primarily in British institutions and highlights efforts for cultural remediation. Vinita Damodaran examines neglected literature and networks in the Imperial Scientific Network, which were crucial to what was a prodigious scientific renaissance in natural history and environmental understanding in the imperial context from the 17th to the 19th century.
Thank you very, very much for that fulsome introduction. It's great to be here among some old friends and colleagues, particularly Claire Langhammer and Lucy Noakes. But I would really like to thank the two institutions, the German Historical Society and the Royal Historical Society, for inviting me. And this is particularly important and resonant of the fact that this is a joint lecture, and I feel very privileged to be presenting at your annual lecture. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to take you through some reading. It's a formal lecture, but I will also be using my PowerPoint a lot more. So bear with me as I take you through this extraordinary archive, which I both try to read with praise and I read against the grain, right? So I wanted to say that the British intellectual engagement with the environments of empire, primarily India, Africa, and the Caribbean and Australia over 200 years, involves the use of colonies for environmental experimentation. South Asia, Africa, and Australia in particular became giant open-air laboratories for scientists attempting to understand, investigate, and manipulate a world of new peoples, species, environments, and diseases. These encounters and interventions had permanent and sometimes adverse, sometimes beneficial consequences for colonized people and their environments. The valuable and extensive documentation of environmental change, indigenous knowledge systems, and practices of natural resource use, I argue, laid the groundwork for much of modern environmental thinking, especially in the tropics. As the research that we've done shows at the center, the continents of India and Africa, which came under colonial rule, provided much of the context for these debates on humans and nature, and India in particular became a template for other parts of the empire. So this is about recentering India in some of these debates. The unprecedented transformation of the landscapes and environments of the world brought about by the British Empire occurred as a physical and biological consequence of economic globalization, nothing surprising here, and territorial expansion. We all know the history of the East India Companies. But what we know less is that the ecological reshaping and it was closely documented and it remains traceable in numerous papers and archives compiled by private individuals and by colonial bureaucracies, naturalists, travelers, and scientific services. Some of the documents and papers are often studied in isolation, but they have only recently started being collected, integrated, and researched for the network of socioeconomic, literary, artistic and ecological information they contain. But a lot of these collections are rich for understanding the environmental history, say, of Ghana or India. And we really need to be able to peruse them to get that information. So what I'm arguing here is when studied in association, these material accounts or this extraordinary archive is a modern doomsday book, account of the impact of European globalizing forces and the impact they had on the environment. Today, of course, global warming, extreme climate events, deforestation, desertification, famine, inequity, pollution, and land degradation are seen as the most alarming and important problems that threaten mankind. There are challenges that we see as quite recent. All of them, and this is very, very important, were described centuries ago, and this is again critical to note, in a colonial context, with, in the context of these various empires, encountering new species, encountering new peoples. For example, the extinction of the dodo had a very, very significant impact on European consciousness, and that was about the 17th century in Mauritius. So these descriptions and the development of the empires, the French, the British, and here I'm concentrating on the British Empire, is of intrinsic importance to the history of culture and the environment. Rates of natural resource exploitation on an entirely new and destructive scale brought about a highly sophisticated and precocious environmentalist response unprecedented in the West. And we know the nature of destruction. Some historians have called it the Pleistocene in lieu of the Anthropocene. The enormous transfer of plants and biota across the world and the planting of huge tracts of coffee, rubber, and so on is a known history. But what is less known is the responses to this sort of dramatic change. Responses to environmental change and novelty differed often fundamentally from territory to territory and continent to continent. But there were important influences and networks as well, and some of them dominated by the metropole and some brought about by hitherto intercolonial patterns of intellectual and bureaucratic exchange. A knowledge of the colonial natural history archives and patterns of information networks is vital to understanding the colonial ecological revolution, while the documentation of individual experiences of colonial territories is crucial if meaningful comparisons are going to be drawn between on the nature of this of colonial impacts on various parts of the world. Research on the imperial response to the natural world cannot exclude the colonial narratives of risks and dangers, again, resonant of today, the fear of climate change. And this was part and parcel of colonial experiences through periods of crisis. What I think we as historians really need to rethink the understandings of crisis and how crisis is perceived and occurs at particular periods. Anxieties about public health, not least in urban areas, as well as the fear of wholesale agrarian failure in the context of India, famines, right? The 1770 famine killed 10 million people, means that a lot of these colonial interventions really sort of dealt with environmental and climatic matters. Many of the connections between botany, meteorology, famine, and disease need to be investigated. So this essay with a focus on India aims to understand this important archive of knowledge organized in the context of empire in the light of recent historiography on botany and empire. So it examines the neglected literature and networks in the imperial scientific world, which were crucial to what was a prodigious, as Lucy Noakes has just said, scientific renaissance in natural history and environmental understanding in the imperial context from the 17th to the 19th century. In doing so, it looks at ideas of drying up or desiccation, colonial narratives of deforestation, soil erosion, the collapse of civilizations, the role of indigenous ideas in these processes. So in some senses, how do we read the archive against the grain? How do we understand the archive to understand the environmental history of these different colonies? And the discourse of climate change and the sort of protections that went on, the conservation that went on in the interests of, say, rain, first is experienced in the Caribbean colonies as a result of the devastating impact of plantation, sugar plantation, agriculture by the late 18th century. It can be argued that the current incorporation of local perspectives in environmental processes has led to the questioning of colonial narratives about different environments in the Caribbean, India, and Africa, and the relations of human societies with them. One important question for us is how do we work through this colonial legacy for the imagination of new political and environmental futures? That is what, for example, I'm trying to do here by looking at contexts of collecting and the ways in which you can uncover or remediate this archive or read this archive against the grain. As historians, we are trained to read these archives against the grain. So the Center for World Environmental History, which I run, we have attempted to play this role in this remediation as a sort of international project, both to understand the archive and to decolonize it in various ways by making them available to a much wider audience. Retelling the story of Indian botany, for example, and collecting can be told as one emerging from colonial origins, but one also embracing the indigenous, the tribal, and gendered approaches to Indian botanical history. So I've tried to do this in some ways. So the archive of natural history is extraordinarily diverse. It ranges from information on landscape features, including remains of imperial institutions, through collections of natural objects such as herbaria and immense quantities of paper records. The archive offers a treasure trove of observations such as climate and weather data, botanical and zoological observations that are of immediate use to a variety of disciplines. Despite being embedded within particular colonial imaginaries and utilitarian objectives such as economic botany, these collections have attracted much scholarship. The largest collections of the Natural History Museum in Kew Gardens are from India, for example. And this came as a surprise to me when I first came here, that we are sitting on this absolute treasure trove. This is why more PhD students perhaps should come here to work on these archives, right? Other parts of the empire also contributed to the range of collections, including the Hans Sloane collection from the Caribbean and the Natural History Museum. Aspects of this archive open up exciting avenues for collaborative work for historians, along with, for example, I've collaborated quite closely with the UK Met Office on climate data. And to use it properly, historians must be aware of the conditions of its production. The cross-cultural nature and the technical challenges demand particular attention. For example, the techniques through which the objects in the economic botany collections, land use patterns, and correspondence networks can be made to speak to each other is slowly emerging. So if we, for example, look at the important archive of rubber collection, we do know that rubber, of course, was in some senses, the history of rubber has this a trajectory which is quite well known. 70,000 rubber seeds were stolen from Brazil, introduced to the botanic gardens in India, and then transplanted around the world with horrible consequences in the Congo, which we know about, which, you know, the horror of the rubber trade. So that sort of history is known, but what is less known is the way in which these plants and the transfer of plants occurred and how with the adoption of the Wardian case, which allowed, for example, tea plants, 20,000 tea plants came from China to India. They didn't survive, I believe, very much. And India then had to go back and the British had to introduce different plants, different tea plants, allowed for not just plantation crops, but also for crops for scientific reasons, plant transfers, which allowed for this prodigious scientific renaissance, which we've just talked about. So how do we bring all this very important material together? How do we read against the grain? And what we've tried to do this is to make these records more publicly accessible by creating a sort of discursive area for this. And institutions like this the RHS and so on can be used to talk about these collections in the ways in which I'm trying to do this here. And by highlighting the hidden histories in the whitewash study of collecting, we can begin to recover the names of indigenous collectors, very much part of the project of work being done by QNAF, sometimes known but omitted from the literature, contributions of indigenous knowledge to the discipline of botany, and the contributions of professional scientists from the colonies. And I mention here E.K. Jonaki Amal, the first female employee of the RHS in Wisley in the 1940s. So the context of collecting then are very, very important. I'll talk a little bit about that. This network that we created, I'll now resort to the PowerPoint a little more. The network that we created was 90 members, and we were trying to understand and uncover these various archives around the world, from Freiburg, which had a very, very interesting project on Arab sources, to the VOC sources, the Dutch sources, all of these. So we had this amazing network that we created as a result of the AHRC, and it was an interdisciplinary network, meteorologists, archaeologists, holding institutions, historians, of course. And it was a wonderful way of conversing about these collections. So the context of collecting, I think, are particularly important. And to me, and we've tried to identify that through much of our work. And at the center, we also raised money right in the beginning to transcribe. And this goes back to the University of Sussex interest to work with Kew Gardens to transcribe the letters of Joseph Hooker, who we thought was very, very important. He brings the rhododendron back to India, and we'll talk a little bit more about him later, because it was what was very, very important to understand the environmental history of India. So this particular project, I think, was initiated in some senses through the work of the center. And I just want to mention here the work of Richard Grove, his classic book, Green Imperialism, which I suppose in some ways encapsulated many of these ideas 30 years ago. So digitizing these vast and dispersed records housed in museums, in botanical archives around the world was the next stage. And you're only able to do very, very little about this. We initiated the project at Sussex, but now, of course, much of the digitization effort is out of our hands, and institutions, of course, have taken it over. But I'll say a little bit about one of these projects at a later stage. So one thing that the project did was to look at Calcutta as the center of calculation. For a lot of these botanical exchanges, Calcutta, this absolutely beautiful house of William Roxburgh by the Hooghly, is falling into a state of ruin at the moment, was where a lot of this work on botany, agriculture, climatology, and medicine was conducted. Very, very interesting. Calcutta was the tail that wagged the dog. Calcutta was more important at this time than Kew, right? So in the 18th century, that particular way in which a lot of these British colonial scientists, and we call them colonial scientists because they were based in the colonies, worked in these institutions and generated these connections, I think are very, very important for us. They were concentrating, for example, on the potential fragility and exhaustibility of nature. They were interested in issues of deforestation and of drying up. When Roxburgh was in Calcutta, he had just come out of the terrible famines on the Coromandel. And so he was really worried about famine foods. The Botanic Garden began to be a place where he experimented with planting. And this interest in botanic gardens, I argue, rose from an earlier interest in the Materia Medica of the Indian Ocean, right? So you've had the classic work of Anna Winterbotham, who was at Sussex, who worked extensively on 15th and 16th century plant collections as a result of medicinal means. And of course, we have two classic collectors in India, Darcy Biorta, who wrote the Colloquios in 1563, and Van Reeder. And these, there was a realization that plants were integral to maritime empires in the 15th century. And between 1500 and 1800, you get this vigorous exchange by people like Darcy Diorta and Van Reeder. So this taxonomic approach of Garcia, who was a Portuguese physician who lived in Goa, and he compiles a detailed list of plants, which he translates into Latin by 1567, and by Clusius. So Clusius goes on to establish botanical gardens in Vienna and in Leiden. You can see the exchange between India, Goa, and Leiden here. The establishment of Dutch power in Cochin resulted also in a new project on the plants of Malabar later on by Van Reeder in 1678. So these two men, I think, are very, very important. For Ortha, he relies on his plant collection on a Konkani slave girl. So he's using indigenous informants here, women. And the colloquios, I think, are really worth reading. They are online. Please read it. And you can see the practices of collecting. I'm interested here in how you can rescue the whitewash story of collecting by looking at the practices of collecting. So in compiling it, as I said, Orta relies on the knowledge of what he calls small people. And he also talks about the success of Malayali physicians, which are physicians from Kerala, in treating their patients, though he notes that it is difficult to gain information from them. Garcia was very aware of caste-based knowledge. The Brahmins were the ones in India who held on to the knowledge, but he then talks about indigenous knowledge held by Malis or gardening castes who were very, very well informed about local plant knowledges. Van Reeder, I think, is even more interesting. He brings upon himself to compose the Materia Medica of India. He relies on local informants between 1678 and 1693. This study is seen to be one of the first surveys of tropical botany in India. But once again, he relies on collecting on non-Brahmin informants. And this, again, I think is very, very important. He notes he was forced to rely on the much greater field knowledge of his low-caste servants, in this case, the Iravas. Brahminical natural science knowledge was, as far as Van Reeder was concerned, merely academic. It thus made sense to bypass the Brahmins. For field collection, I quote from him, he relied on certain men who were experts in plants, who, I quote, were entrusted with collecting from everywhere the plants with the leaves, flowers, and fruit, for which they even climbed the highest tops of trees. I mean, you were talking here about, quote, close, toddy tappers, or people who climbed the coconut palm, right, who are generally of the Iruva caste. So it was Van Reeder's contact with these lower caste collectors, that of the toddy tapper caste, adept at tree planting and plant identification, that awoke in him the wider value of the knowledge possessed by his caste. And he identifies the main person in identifying these plants as a chap called Itti Achyudan. The botanist K.S. Manilal describes the hottest as a treatise that gives minute details about Kerala herbs concerning the description and illustration of over 780 plant names. It's very, very interesting that the hottest identifies indigenous informants in a most remarkable way, which we stop noticing later on. It's also important that the classification of plants relies on local plant names. For example, flowers used for onam, cherry onapu, velia onapu. So there you get these local classifications, which then later enters into linear plant classifications, right? So use value of plants, which I think is very, very important in this early phase of plant collecting and recognitions of indigenous knowledge. And remember that the impact of the Hortus Malabaricus, and again, you can see this, is a huge book on which enormous care was expended. And it would have cost a fortune before its publication. And the identification of indigenous artists with it, or indigenous plant collectors with it, is extremely important for us. By the 18th century, you get, of course, the professionalization of science. The professionalization and state patronage are exemplified, of course, in the career of Joseph Banks. We do know about Joseph Banks, botanist, naturalist, and patron of the sciences between 1770 and 1810, through his financing of the Cook voyages. The activities of the naturalist on Cook's voyages enabled a new social empiricism and a scientific critique. The foundation of the system of botanic gardens on the company also moved beyond the economic agenda and provided an intellectual conduit for ideas not only on plant transfers, but interestingly on climatic environmentalism, conservation, and reforestation. In the botanic gardens in Mauritius, St. Helena, the Cape, and Calcutta, these researches were shared through these imperial networks, and deforestation and extinction concerns of earlier years grew into government policy. So it's quite important that you get, for example, in the work of William Roxburgh, this merger of interests. He draws the plants of the Coromandel. Again, there's a picture, in the 19th century picture of the Calcutta Botanic Garden. But in this plants of the, he uses Indian artists. Remember that the herbarium specimens are difficult to identify. So Indian artists are used, new techniques of gouache painting and natural pigments from Indian miniature are used. And of course, the Indian artists find it difficult. And very often, some of the artists are forced to work in here, as the recent exhibition of Flora Indica by the remarkable Henry Nolte and Sarah Reddy shows that while for the first time in Kew, you can still see this exhibition, I think it's still on, Indian artists are being mentioned, Gaurachand Vishnu Prasad in the Wallach collection, Brijlal in the Adam Freer collection, and insight into working conditions. But also what comes out is Roxburgh's prodigious sort of intelligence and his interest in preventing India from descending into the famine that he saw when he arrived, right? And he was also very, very worried about the sort of terrible sort of floods that he encountered in Madras and the Coromandel. So Roxburgh is very interesting because he's not only a botanist, he keeps a detailed meteorological diary in Madras. And that is the knowledge that he then brings to Calcutta, where he sets about creating this very, very exciting botanic garden, right? Which I said in many ways is a precursor to the sort of scientific experimentation that goes on in Kew. So the importance of Calcutta as a center for calculation, again, brings about this remedial narrative of a botany in the context of empire. And it's also important that meteorology develops in India. And India is quite critical to the science of meteorology. Cyclonology, the world cyclone, is developed in India by scientists such as Piddington. So Roxburgh's meteorological collections and typhoon mapping. So he, as I say, is extremely interested in the Indian monsoon, right? So monsoon mapping, I have made and noted down many observations on its uses when in large practice in the General Hospital at Madras in 1776, 78, he lost all my papers, but this by the storm and inundation at and near Coringa in May 1787. So a lot of meteorologists are able to date things like El Nino according to the ways in which Roxburgh's meteorological diary is kept. So this is before the instrumental data of the 1880s and 1870s is available. So a lot of climate, people interested in historical climatology are interested in these archives. And these early colonial naturalists are collecting weather data on a big way. And botanic gardens as well are extremely important because they have rain gauges, right? So the data from them and from, of course, plantations is now becoming increasingly important to understand the weather and to understand patterns of long-term patterns of global climate because of El Nino and La Nina events. And once again, there's a lot emerging literature that you all would be interested in here. The Madras typhoon of 1787, I think, is very particular and important about this. So I think in many ways, Roxburgh and his successor, Nathaniel Wallich, who was a Dane, who took over the superintendency of the Calcutta Botanic Garden, they had clearly set up an information network where India was at the center. Wallich himself becomes a very, very strong advocate of understanding Indian plants and an advocate of tree planting globally. So tree planting becomes quite important for the East India Company. And not just plants which are necessary for the village, for example, plantains, jackfruit, and breadfruit, but also palmera trees, which we now know is very important as a protector of cyclones in South India. So the plants reproduced in the volume Plants of Coromandel was a selection made from 500 drawings and descriptions presented to the Honorable Court of Directors by William Roxburgh. But what is important and interesting is that in a lot of the paintings at this time, the Indian artists were identified. The Indian artists were identified. And this, again, is something that's going to change as the century wears on. And why is it that the Indian artists were identified? Because there was a lot of admiration for Indian art. Roxburgh was trained in Edinburgh under John Hope, was a friend of the Dutch botanist Johan Koenig, who was botanizing in the Danish colony of Tranquebar. Tranquebar is another important arena where in South India, next to or further down the coast from Madras or Chennai now, where a lot of Danish missionaries were active. And they were also enormously interested in tree plantation and in collecting various plants. So the knowledge between these different empires, between the French, the Danes, and the British in India, I think is quite important in this period. And the Roxburgh plants reproduced here are important not just for their aesthetic value, but for their food value, because as I said, he was very, very interested in famine plants. And he's promoting the science of these plants in India, and he's lobbying the East India Company to give more funds to his work. And I think this, again, is very, very important. So we move on gradually now to the 19th century collecting. And this is where we have Joseph Hooker, who I've mentioned, who's one of the early directors of Kew. And in 1840s, he is been to India. He's traveling in India. He's collecting the rhododendron, as he says. And we had the Hooker India letters. I mentioned him already as part of the transcription project. But Hooker's, as part of the project, we also tried to connect up his ethnography with his plant collecting. But he's very, very interesting for us because he collects 7,000 species of plants. He is extremely interested in documenting the plant history of India, but he's also very dismissive of indigenous plant collectors, right? And why is that? His travels and letters to India between 1847 and 51 highlight the importance of India to the study of systematic botany. One of the most traveled botanists in the world, he was only 34 when he came back from India. Between 1851 and 52, he worked on the floras of India and his conception of species being more variable and more delimited emerged as a result of his work on India. So India again becomes central to his scientific thinking. However, he is very dismissive of his plant collectors. And this, I think, is a remarkable change. He is identifying broad species, but he's erasing indigenous knowledge, right? He's erasing indigenous knowledge. He had discovered plants growing at higher altitudes than anyone had ever previously been known possible. Herbaceous plants growing as high as 18,000 feet, and some cryptograms going even higher, as he says. He had also had drawings of 700 plants, plus sketches of landscape, geology, and local peoples. In 1853, he estimated that there were no more than 50,000 instead of 70 to 100,000 known species of plants. So he's delimiting the species. He drew meaningful comparisons between the flora of different regions. But when you look at his use of plant names, what becomes apparent is the loss of indigenous nomenclature in the intervening period between Van Reeder's Hortus Malabaricus, Roxburgh's 18th century, and Nathaniel Wallich's 18th and early 19th century naming of indigenous plant collectors. By this period, Hooker is very dismissive of indigenous plant names. He says, for example, native plant names have been retained with great unwillingness. At the same time, he romanticizes the Lepcha of Sikkim plant collectors in 1849, where he talks about being surrounded by my Lepchans. Plant collectors while he inspects the contents of his vascular. And this sort of image goes around the world. This becomes the subject for the F. Stone painting of Hooker in the Himalayas. And he also remarks on the people of Digchuan bordering Tibet as being uncouth and boisterous and could be kept in order by great bullying. So you find, once again, the sort of dismissive attitude to the plant knowledge of indigenous communities. His drawings on India are an outstanding resource on local ecology and landscape. Again, we can read them against the grain, which is what we historians do. And his drawing of Mount Everest is seen as the first representation of the mountain. He keeps a meteorological diary and he takes regular meteorological readings, which he sends to Professor Wheatstone, co-inventor of the electric telegraph, telling him, my objects are purely botanical, but I hope by the careful use of good instruments to obtain data for calculating the effects of climate on the vegetation of large areas. So Hooker's ideas of climate and biogeography were influenced by, of course, Alexander von Humboldt, the great German naturalist, and Charles Darwin, the latter being a friend. A close relationship between Hooker and Darwin also sort of develops. So what are we doing with this sort of material? So highlighting what we've done so far is highlighting the context of collecting, highlighting the way in which there is more of a sort of a dismissal of indigenous plant knowledge from the 17th century to the 19th century. And this becomes quite instructive for us as we see ideas of race developing much more in the laboratory. And I think that becomes important for us to understand that happening, right? And it also results in local plant variation and cultures of plant knowledges being dismissed in some senses. And it's only in the 20th century that we get challenges posed to the Q paradigm through the work of E.K. Janaki Amal, who's trained in the Western mode of science, but she is very, very critical of Q, and she challenges both the scientific patriarchy of science, but also the ways in which a systematic botany was conducted. And she is implicitly critiquing Q, though she herself is a systematic botanist. She becomes the fellow. Very little is known about her. We've just recovered. There's now the Indian government is now instituting awards in her name. She becomes a fellow of the Linnean Society, the Royal Geographical Society, the Asiatic Society of Bengal, the Royal Asiatic Society of London, and the Indian Academy of Sciences. She was subject to both racism in the West, though she worked for many years in the John Innes Institute, and she worked, of course, in Kew. But under J.B.S. Haldane, C.D. Darlington, she faced a lot of very limited praise for her work. And in India, her papers were not sent up to Nature or delayed for several years, especially her crosses. She worked on Bambusia crosses, right? So her story, I think, is indicative of the way in which science functioned in the colonies and how the patriarchy of science still functions. So she wrote this classic book called The Chromosome Atlas of Cultivated Plants with C.D. Darlington, a magnum opus, very, very understudied. And he then tried to get a second edition and she turned her nose up at it because by then their relationship, the academic relationship and personal relationship had soured. And it was very interesting that he had done the work and he was the first leading author, but she had he thought he had done the work, but clearly he hadn't. It had all been done by her. And he really found it very difficult to produce the second edition without her. Anyway, she became the first director of the Central Botanical Laboratory of the Government of India in Lucknow. And she became Nehru's right-hand woman, as it were, leading the Botanical Survey of India. What is less known is she was the first female employee of the RHS at Wisley, right? And only recently has she entered the sort of pantheon of scientists of the RHS. You can still see her magnolia, and it's quite important to reassert her and to present her to a national and international audience and correcting the record of Indian natural history. And now I come to the last remedial, last section, which I'll go whiz through these slides, which is how we've sort of tried to work through this history and present it and package it for new audiences and work on this project of cultural remediation through our school project, which we first started about 10 years ago. The Hooker exhibition, which was curated by Q, we took, and you can see the Q people there, Gina Fuller Love, who's become a great friend. We took it back to Calcutta. Of course, Q charged us £40,000 to take this exhibition back, which, you know, I think was a pity. But here it is. And we sort of, in some senses, centered Janakia Mall in the center of the exhibition. So you have to go through Janakia Mall to enter Q. So it's as though sort of decentering the whole narrative. And that, I think, and that was the only thing that the Botanical Survey of India had on Janakia Mall was that little bust. They'd forgotten the history. They'd obliterated it. And it is so important that she's now being understood and contextualized within this amazing history of plant collecting. We also got school children involved in the exhibition. I mean, here you see boys, but there were lots of girls. And we produced these leaflets in Bengali and we got scientists for the first time who are very bureaucratic. Indian scientists in the Botanical Survey of India have a colonized mind. So we were trying to decolonize their minds as well. And say, open up your collections to local. And we are doing this also, the same project we're doing in Tobago, where we are forcing scientists to go out and connect with young children. All right. And the other thing we did with an NHM was we got the BSI, Botanical Survey of India, to link up with an NHM, and we managed to get lots of thousands of Indian plants, about 300,000 Indian plants to be digitized, which was necessary for their flora of India. It's quite important to note that since Hooker wrote his Flora of India in several volumes, there's no new Flora of India. Right? And it's only now that the flora of India is coming out. And they felt stymied because a lot of the herbarium specimens were not accessible to them. They were here, right? So I think this is, of course, now there's remedial action being taken to digitize all type specimens. So I think in many ways, this was a step in the right direction. But this is just a tip of the iceberg, right? More recently, we are taking this particular project of Thomas Wardle, which is the Dyes of India. And this is a very new project, which is about reinstating India into the arts and crafts movement. So Thomas Wardle, because the British sent India as part of their economic botany activities to collect the dyes of India from 64 plants. And he did, and this became extremely critical because William Morris and Thomas Wardle spent hours of trying to find out about these plants and using them for their textiles because they were very unhappy with the way in which the textiles were being dyed at that time. And we are now, and this collection is only in Calcutta, and it's in a really dire state. And we are trying to persuade the Botanical Survey of India, who are attempting to digitize it, but they're not doing the digitizing the report, not only to conserve it, but we are also involving using our Arts Weights workshops to get the scientists to go out to this very marginal area of the Sundarbans, where the children who we are working with in terms of climate resilience and climate knowledges of this disappearing delta, we are getting them to work with natural dyes that they can source from their own mangroves. And here, this particular work has got enormous relevance to the current sustainable livelihood debate and for, you know, just transitions using colonial archives and colonial collections to achieve this. And we had a very, very successful dyeing workshop with using Wardle's sort of dyes and using mordants. He hid the mordants, so using other mordants. And we sort of, this is an ongoing sort of project for decolonizing those colonial collections. So again, that's the state of the book. There's 15 volumes, an 82-page report. So let's hope we can conserve it. But certainly it's got a new lease of life in the Sundarbans, which is this disappearing delta, which is in India and Bangladesh shares the Sundarbans, which is the delta, which is about 10, over 10,000 square kilometers. And the project that we have is on one of these islands. So it's got 54 islands in the Indian Sundarbans, many of them disappearing. And the children and youth we are working with are traumatized by, of course, cyclones, landslides, landslips, and tigers. And so we've been working with tiger widows and women and youth to do this, to bring the water collection to these communities. So how do we sort of bring these collections, reinstate them, tell the stories of their collecting, read against the grain? We've done that with the 17th to 19th century sort of collections, but also then reinserting hidden histories of our Ammal, and then bring these collections to local communities by decolonizing the bureaucratic minds of people of the Botanic Survey of India, by helping to create a new flora of India and retelling the story of Indian botany as one emerging from its colonial origins, but moving on to encompass, as I said, these tribal, indigenous, and gender sort of approaches. There's one legacy that I'm using art-based workshops to do this. This is, of course, very recent. This is a November workshop that we just had. And we're working there with the scientists of the Botanical Survey, that lady in blue, and with Dr. Anandita Saha, who is a very, very close collaborator. And we're using native plants mentioned in the Diaries of Wattle, Arjun, eucalyptus, marigold, and vegetable waste, in this case. Some local plants used and some local plants that have just emerged. But this is one, I want to leave you with this slide. This is Roxborough's house. You saw the beautiful garden. This is the state of the house now. This is one colonial heritage which the Botanical Survey of India is not very keen to restore because they don't have the money. They've moved on to a very snazzy new place. But we've been trying and they are interested. Colonial British heritage in India is, architectural heritage is quite important. But whose heritage is this? So I leave you with that slide.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.